Je voudrais remercier Judith Boxer d'être avec nous. Ça a été un peu compliqué à réaliser, mais enfin nous y sommes parvenus. La vie n'est pas simple en ce moment. Elle n'est déjà pas simple pour ceux qui vivent en France, mais je peux vous dire que quand vous vivez au Mexique, c'est beaucoup plus compliqué de façon générale. Donc merci Judith d'être avec nous. Je vais dire quelques mots de Judith. Judith est institutionnellement professeure de sciences politiques à la UNAM. Moi, je l'ai connue, elle dirigeait le postgrado, c'est-à-dire le doctorat, en gros, de sciences politiques de cette université. C'est une chercheuse, pour moi, d'abord, une scientifique, sociologue, sciences politiques, qui a des très, très importantes publications. Je ne peux pas les citer en anglais, en espagnol, parfois en français, parfois traduites dans d'autres langues, sur des questions dont certaines sont absolument tout à fait au cœur de notre réflexion, de multiculturalisme, d'identité juive, de diaspora, de multiculturalisme. Enfin, c'est vraiment une œuvre qui nous touche beaucoup, avec évidemment des choses très importantes sur l'Amérique latine ou sur le Mexique ou l'Argentine en particulier. Judith est quelqu'un qui a de nombreuses marques de reconnaissance et distinctions diverses. Moi, je retiendrai surtout qu'elle est membre de l'Académie mexicaine des sciences et depuis quelques mois, présidente de l'association, je vais le dire en anglais, c'est une association qui a un nom anglais, Association for Social Scientific Study of Jewry, l'association des chercheurs qui travaillent sur la question juive des études. J'étais à son invitation d'ailleurs, j'étais au dernier colloque de cette association. C'était très impressionnant, il y avait beaucoup de monde. Je crois que j'étais le seul Français, et ça m'a beaucoup fait réfléchir à la question de l'internationalisation des sciences sociales. Qu'est-ce qui fait que quand il y a une énorme association comme celle-là, avec des chercheurs du monde entier, je peux vous dire, les Français n'y soient pas, ou pratiquement pas. Donc je le signale, et donc Judith est présidente de cette association. Et puis je terminerai cette présentation, on pourrait passer des heures, Judith, mais je pense qu'il ne faut pas trop en faire non plus, en disant que Judith a relancé la grande revue de sciences sociales et politiques mexicaines, et donc latino-américaines, qui s'appelle la revue mexicaine de sciences politiques et sociales. Et c'est une revue qui est extrêmement prestigieuse, très très importante, et qui est vraiment une revue très 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 remarquable, donc je voulais le signaler. C'est une revue qui va bien au-delà du Mexique et même de l'Amérique latine, je dirais même du monde qui parle espagnol. C'est vraiment une revue à caractère international. Donc voilà ce que je voulais dire pour te présenter, Judith. Tout le monde aura compris qu'en plus, Judith est une amie, mais ça, c'est la vie intellectuelle. Parfois, on a la chance de pouvoir conjuguer la vie intellectuelle et la vie amicale, et c'est toujours une grande joie. Voilà, je voudrais remercier Régis, qui a fait un très gros travail depuis de longs mois, y compris pour que cette réunion d'aujourd'hui soit possible, et remercier aussi Emmanuel, que je voyais tout à l'heure, je ne la vois plus, mais voilà, ah, si, ça y est, je la vois, Emmanuel Korn, qui assure que tout ça restera dans la mémoire collective, sous des formes accessibles, et ça, c'est des choses aussi très, très, très importantes. Voilà pour cette présentation. Judith, je crois que je vais te donner la parole. Donc Judith va s'exprimer en anglais, je résumerai de temps en temps pour que ceux qui ont des difficultés, mais Judith est quelqu'un qui parle un anglais très très agréable à entendre et qui ne parle jamais trop vite, donc on peut la suivre en principe sans trop de difficultés. Judith.
Merci beaucoup Michel. Je m'excuse que je veux parler en anglais, ce que j'ai déjà dit. Pour moi, sera plus facile, mais je devrais donner ma parole de que la prochaine fois, on le va faire en français. Ce que j'ai déjà dit, beaucoup des années qui a passé, on a donné l'opportunité avec Michel d'attendre des colloquiums, des séminaires, des conférences. Et je pense que maintenant, ce que tu as dit, Michel, est très important. On va essayer les deux d'ouvrir l'association à les amis, les collègues de France pour faire une plus intéressante transnationale perspective d'analyse. Alors, et je vous remercie. Je veux dire que les amis de Michel sont mes amis et des collègues aussi sont mes collègues. C'est que la première fois que j'ai écouté cette expression, les amis de Michel, a été déjà, tu te rappelles, la conférence avec Alain Touraine, avec Emmanuel Castel, des amis tu as invités. On a fait ces sessions très intéressantes de Alain Gulbenkian et Commission. Alors, si vous me permettez, je vais aller à le PowerPoint et sera plus facile. Alors, c'est le nom, le titre de ma conférence et je vais essayer de clarifier le concept de synopia et pentimenti. I refer to the conceptual approaches and changing path of anti-Semitism in Latin America. Now, there are several remarks, introductory remarks, that I want to share with you. And I commit to translate this PowerPoint to French and send you immediately. And afterward, I'll send also the text. I refer to anti-Semitism recurrences and changes, and they display diverse dimensions over globally interconnected realms or spheres that are mediated by shared regional traits and local singular configurations. The need to overcome, and this is my approach to our subject, and the relationship of anti-Semitism with racism, as I know is the platform that you share. The need to overcome only comparative perspective and enter a relational methodology. Now, I refer that the historical changing shapes meaning of the negative conceptual representation and images of the Jews. We'll see later if only Jews. The recurrences of original Judeophobia, referring to that, to the historical development of this negative attitude and not only to the modern phenomenon of anti-Semitism, have shifting significance. And there are overlapping of old and new expressions, mainly at the meaning-making level. All these characteristics provide a fertile field for analysis. So my focus of research has been anti-Semitism's symbolic and conceptual representations and the way they are produced and reproduced discursively. This, to my understanding, poses a new challenge to social research. And I refer to the negative tropos of the Jew and its changing meaning, role, and functionality across time and across distinctive social, economical, political, and cultural constellations. Having said so, of course I understand that discrimination necessitates also behavioral, social, and legal means in order to enforce certain practices. Most importantly, the social forces, political frameworks, and institutions, as we will say today also, technological mechanism, economic condition, have historically, periodically driving the revival of this persisting myth, but they are not the same in this similar context. But they also need to be approached in relational terms. And this is valid when approaching anti-Semitism and racism.
So,
yeah, common. I'll finish this, Michelle, and, okay. I'll listen. We have common, shared, and singular. We have convergences and divergences. Related to the other, the visible, the invisible, the outsider that may become historically the insider. And the challenge is to overcome not only methodological nationalism, as we all know from our late friend Ulrich Beck, but also methodological separatism. I mean, studying these dos phenomenon totally disconnected. Michel, please.
Alors, ça fait énormément de choses. Je vais essayer d'insister sur quelques points. Judith voudrait insister sur le fait qu'il faut dépasser de façon générale les démarches uniquement comparatistes. Elle voudrait insister aussi sur le fait qu'il ne faut pas traiter d'un côté de l'antisémitisme et d'un autre côté du racisme, comme si c'était des univers totalement disjoints. Elle insiste beaucoup, s'il s'agit de l'antisémitisme, sur le fait que c'est un phénomène qui à la fois se reproduit et se produit, est à la fois dans la continuité et dans la transformation, ce qui est un défi intellectuel considérable. Que ce phénomène s'alimente d'éléments très anciens, même pré-modernes, et en même temps un phénomène profondément moderne, donc un phénomène qui fait revivre des mythes, des éléments qui peuvent être anciens, mais qui en même temps les transforment. C'est ce genre de choses sur lesquelles elle voudrait insister, mais le point clé par lequel elle vient de conclure cette première ensemble de remarques, le point clé, c'est l'idée qu'il faut dépasser ce qu'elle appelle, en référence à Ulrich Beck, le séparatisme méthodologique. Vous savez qu'Ulrich Beck critiquait le nationalisme méthodologique, le séparatisme méthodologique qui consiste à séparer l'analyse de l'antisémitisme de l'analyse du racisme, car tout ça pose la question de ce qui est convergent et ce qui est divergent, la question aussi de comment aborder ce qui est visible et ce qui est invisible, comment réfléchir au fait que l'outsider, celui qui est du dehors, devient ou est aussi un insider, il est aussi dedans. Voilà le genre de questions que Judith souhaite aborder.
Et merci Michel, merci beaucoup. On va continuer, merci. My research has mainly focused on anti-Semitism, but I am aware that today in Europe, not only anti-Semitism is a new vital pathology, but also we face Islamophobia. And I think that one of the interesting points is that looking at the historical development of this phenomenon of discrimination and its extreme expressions, we have to ask about the religious sources of race, about the racialization of cultures that can bring us back, as I will try to see, to expressions that precede the modern times and modernity, though we'll focus on anti-Semitism in modern time. What I refer is that both Jews and the Islam were, for the Western European world, historically a challenge to face in different terms. And this is part of our, I would say, goal today. I said, as Michel reinforced, that antisemitism is produced and reproduced discursively. Other forms, like Islamophobia, too. And there are subjective, there are stereotypes, myths, aptitudes, and they are behavioral, right? Action, practices, and institutional arrangement. And therefore, I refer with this extreme, I would say, inspiring for me expression that comes from the art, that is Sinopia and Pentimenti, which means that Sinopia were the preparatory drawings made on the wall on which a fresco or a mural will tend to be painted. And what is interesting is that this was pre-designed, right? The draw was before the artist went to the wall. But also we have Pentimenti, which are changing that the artist makes on the original composition during the process. That means that you can perceive the changes in the underlying layers of the painting. So this can be applied as a metaphor to the changing meanings, also iconography, of the conceptual stereotypes of Jews, the Hello. Recurring of original sketches, and not only for this. Let me just go one step further. It is also for us as social scientists, as researchers, we need to know that there is a sort, as in the wall or in the painting, a distortion effect, a biased effect, in as much as we are part, of the reality, and we oscillate as researchers in between subjectivity and our goal to science as a method. So I am aware that today, and that's very important, we may explain also why, from one side, antisemitism, from the other, Islamophobia, are recurrently out of the sphere of studies in racism and race. That's very, very interesting. If you look at an important anthologies and works and books of research, you will see always this separation. Probably race and racism has the main reference, certainly in the North American Academy, to the people of color, meaning by that the situation in the States. Shall I stop here, Michel?
Yes, please. Oui, s'il te plaît, parce qu'on arrive à des choses compliquées. Donc, Judith explique qu'elle a travaillé sur l'antisémitisme essentiellement, mais elle ne peut pas réfléchir aujourd'hui à l'antisémitisme sans considérer un autre phénomène, l'islamophobie. Just one word to Judith. In France, there is a big debate, should we use or not the word Islamophobia? But this is not at stake in what you are discussing.
Oh non, je sais, Michel.
Et donc voilà.
Ça que je dis. Pardon, continue. Pardon.
Oui. Non, donc c'est juste pour dire, pour l'instant, on n'entre pas dans cette discussion. Donc, oui. les phénomènes, les développements historiques de ces phénomènes, c'est important de bien voir que le point de départ est religieux. Et donc, il y a des sources religieuses à ce que Judith a appelé la racialisation de la culture. Et que ces sources religieuses sont certainement pré-modernes, datent de l'époque avant l'époque moderne, et qu'aujourd'hui, pour le monde occidental, aussi bien le judaïsme que l'islam sont des défis à affronter. Et donc, c'est ces défis qu'il s'agit d'envisager, et pour les aborder, Judith propose deux concepts. Si tu peux revenir en arrière sur l'image précédente, le concept de Sinopia et le concept de...
Pentimenti.
et de Pentimenti. Et voilà.
It's a metaphor, a ludic metaphor, voilà. Right.
Alors, sinopia, c'est ce qui, avant qu'un artiste fasse une fresque, est prédessiné pour guider son dessin. Autrement dit, c'est pas lui qui a dessiné d'ailleurs normalement le comment dirais-je les premiers éléments à partir desquels l'artiste fera le travail plus d'artiste proprement dit. Donc c'est ce qui est préparé sur le mur pour une fresque, et pentimenti, c'est ce qui renvoie au fait que l'artiste va apporter à plusieurs reprises des changements sur ce qu'il est en train de dessiner et sur le point de départ également. Et donc, il apporte des changements devant le processus. Et si on regarde, si on a accès aux différentes couches de son travail, on s'aperçoit que les choses ont évolué. Eh bien, ces deux notions de sinopia et de pentimenti peuvent nous aider à réfléchir à ce qu'est l'antisémitisme ou l'islamophobie aujourd'hui. Alors, le point important, si je vais à l'essentiel de ce qu'a dit Judith, c'est que quand on considère la...
Oui, oui, c'est vrai. Je dis que aussi la métaphore, on peut l'utiliser pour le distortion effect et on peut dire la distorsion que des fois nous avons, comme nous sommes social researchers, we are engaged in research, and sometimes we predefine our object of study. What I meant mainly is that in our discussion, there is the impact of other levels of, I would say, other dimensions. And the example you brought is precisely, I didn't commit to the concept to Islamophobia, but I brought it just as I tried to say, as part of the debate and discussion, what we are having today. From one side, you see this, and from the other side, we'll arrive also to see anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, anti-Israel, all these configurations refer both to concepts and to realities. So I will continue and I will...
Juste un mot sur un point très important, peut-être le point le plus important de tout ce qu'a dit Judith jusqu'ici, c'était à la fin. C'est qu'elle constate que dans la recherche, dans la vie scientifique, il y a d'un côté ce qui concerne la race et le racisme, et en général, si on regarde les États-Unis, c'est la question noire, et d'un autre côté, ce qui concerne l'antisémitisme ou l'islamophobie. Que ce sont des registres séparés dans la vie de la recherche. Et donc ça, c'est un point qui est pour nous extrêmement important, puisque notre plateforme, elle essaie justement de ne pas séparer complètement ces deux registres.
Oui, je pense que c'est très important. Merci, Michel. Je vais avancer à dire that when I refer to antisemitism as produced and reproduced, I don't think it's the phenomenon of an Hydra explanation. I mean, the same monster that repeats itself all the time with the same head. No, no, not at all. I refer to the different geological layers that we find in the building of the tropos. And these are metaphors that objectify imaginaries, different matrix of imaginaries. For example, the people that killed God, money lovers, immoral, selfish, responsible for a world and air is lacking conspiracy. And also we see here the concept of Bourdieu of habitus, I mean, these classification schemes that work as distinct signs, liberalism, secular, religious, just to bring all together this phenomenon in a body. And if we talk about tropos, we go also in a sense to Foucault's concept of topos, which means how do you imaginary frame the other. Right. So this is one to see mainly imaginaries that are behind the negative tropos. And also I will refer to the social organization of hate and hate speech. What does it mean? How the versions of the other are communicated in society through a multiplicity of discursive resources and narrative. I refer mainly to my research. I've been working with media, with official government documents, with policy making, with social movements, trying to see how the organization of hate and hate speech takes place in a society.
Alors, donc, donc il s'agit de voir comment l'antisémitisme se produit et se reproduit, et pas du tout avec l'image de l'hydre qui serait toujours la même, mais qui aurait un monstre qui se reproduit. C'est pas ça, c'est tout à fait différent, c'est différentes couches géologiques, en quelque sorte, qui s'objectivent et qui alimentent donc tous les stéréotypes dont elle nous a donné un certain nombre. Ils ont tué Dieu, les Juifs ont tué Dieu, les Juifs aiment l'argent, les Juifs sont égoïstes, les Juifs conspirent, ce genre de choses. Donc tout ceci, l'antisémitisme construit l'autre, c'est-à-dire le Juif, de façon imaginaire. Et ce dont va nous parler Judith, c'est de la recherche qu'elle a faite, plus précisément sur l'organisation de la haine et du discours de la haine à travers tout ce qu'elle a trouvé comme matériaux, des récits, des discours dans les médias, des documents, mais aussi en travaillant sur des mouvements sociaux. Donc voilà, elle va nous rendre compte de cette recherche.
Oui, c'est vrai. Et ce qu'on va voir, j'écris ici, « They see the old people, right? There is an eye lacking, money lovers, immoral, selfish, but I can continue. Rich, powerful, selfish, alien, unrooted, an exclusive caste, a distinct racial character, Jewish world domination, world conspiracy. We are going to see all these diverse approaches as I referred as geological levels, right? So let me do with you a very, very quick overlook of what is, to my understanding, the historical dimension of these geological levels. You know, usually, and before the last decades, Latin America was seen as a region that was characterized by anti-Semitism. And I think that we must avoid simplistic and reductionist approaches. And if I look, I also understand that there is a legacy of problems that have nourished this image historically. Let us start from the Inquisition to the conquest, right? The Inquisition in Europe, and then the conquest of Latin America. They go hand by hand. The same year that Jews were expelled from Spain, the same year Cristobal Colón wrote to the king that he's now, and refers to that, after having expelled the Jews from our territories, we are now going to new territories. So over there, we see the coincidence in between the conquest, in between the slavery that was brought to the new territories of this, following Wallerstein expression, this new world system that was created precisely when the Americas were discovered or conquered. From this to the nation building and search for national integration. We'll see that this became one of the references of the constellation that were problematic to face the Jews as others. I remain, if you look with me to the lower part of this PowerPoint, I wrote the avatars of Latin America facing Western modernity and also national belonging. I will refer to that. Then we have all the problematic of the politicized ethnicities. Michelle, I will leave this this image, this slide, when you refer to that. Then we have a history of contradictory efforts to reach or build modernity. Eisenstadt called it multiple modernities. Whitehead called Latin America as the mausoleum of modernities. Then we'll see nationalism and its bifurcation. For this, I will explain. And then we have this idea of peripheral nationalism, mainly peripheral fascism, and its claim to be inclusionary and its result of being exclusionary. Fascism versus liberalism, the way it was fought in Latin America, the idea and the reality of violent cultures and the role of the Catholic Church, both bringing Catholicism as a civic religion and both being a source of intolerance. And we arrive to the last, I would say, epoch of populism and their discursive people. Are Jews inside the good people, the people to which populism referred? What has happened in Latin America with the transition to democracy and the dissolvent democracies? Progression and regression. And all the time, I would say, the redefinition of globality and globalization, for which Michelle is truly someone that is a thought and thinks about, and how it expresses in the regional analysis, and what we may call recurrent crisis. Of course, if I refer to recurrent crisis, I have in mind that critical configurations are a territory that invites to and intensify the expression of discrimination, of inculpation of the other, of exclusion. Michelle, here I stop, and I think that probably it's...
Alors, donc, il s'agit de voir comment s'est construit l'antisémitisme dans l'histoire de l'Amérique latine. Donc, si vous regardez comme moi ce tableau, ce document que nous avons sous les yeux, ça commence avec l'Inquisition et la conquête, les deux en même temps. Vous savez, ça je le précise, tout le monde n'a pas forcément ça en tête, que l'Inquisition a persécuté les Juifs, qu'il fallait cesser, fallait les exclure, et on ne pouvait plus rester en Espagne, au Portugal, etc. Donc, l'Inquisition s'est mise en place en période de conquête. Et donc, les deux phénomènes marchent ensemble, c'est le point de départ. Ensuite, si on veut réfléchir à l'antisémitisme en Amérique latine, il faut bien voir que c'est associé au thème de la construction de la nation et de la politisation, si je peux le dire comme ça, des ethnicités, ou à l'apparition d'ethnicités politisées. Et donc, tout ça nous donne des choses très contradictoires dans les efforts pour construire la modernité, parce que ça va dans un sens et dans un autre. Si vous regardez la deuxième ligne de ce document, on a affaire à des nationalismes en Amérique latine qui sont périphériques, ce n'est pas l'Europe. Ces nationalismes vont avoir leur bifurcation. Si vous voulez suivre pas à pas, en quelque sorte, l'antisémitisme, il faudrait suivre toutes ces bifurcations dans les nationalismes d'Amérique latine, ce qui renvoie à la thèse de Shmuel-Eisenstadt, je pense que c'est SNE, la thèse sur les multiple modernities. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a non pas une modernité, mais des modernités multiples, ce qui illustrerait parfaitement l'Amérique latine, ou bien ce que propose Whitehead, qui est un autre concept, l'Amérique latine comme mausolée des modernités au pluriel. Oui, c'est quand même bon. Et donc l'antisémitisme, vous ne pouvez pas le comprendre si vous faites abstraction de ce genre d'analyse. Ensuite vient la période fasciste, la période où l'on doit choisir entre fascisme et libéralisme, le fait que les cultures latino-américaines sont très violentes et le rôle très fort, très important dans la haine des Juifs de l'Église catholique, y compris quand le catholicisme devient une sorte de religion civique. Ce qui est un peu paradoxal, peut-être que Judith pourra nous en parler. Ensuite, dernière ligne de cette histoire, des crises récurrentes. La région se redéfinit, sa place, si on réfléchit globalement, se redéfinit, et il faut introduire des critères, des analyses de ce qu'elle appelle dissolvent democracies. J'avais jamais vu l'expression juste ici, des démocraties dissolvantes. Hein, et bien entendu, poser la question des populismes. Vous savez que l'Amérique latine a été le continent des populismes. Et que la place des Juifs dans le populisme est intéressante. Est-ce qu'ils font partie du peuple ou est-ce qu'ils ne font pas partie du peuple? Peut-être que c'est les deux à la fois, mais voilà. Donc, c'est ça le paysage d'ensemble qui permet d'aborder la question de la haine des Juifs en Amérique latine.
Merci, merci Michel. Mais certainement, ce n'est pas une évolution linéaire. It is not a linear evolution. All the phases are interactive, but if I want to synthesize, and that's what I wanted, is that there is a continent that it's characterized by its permanent search of modernity, and to this Whitehead refers the goal to reach modernity and the failure. And we'll end with a radical critique of modernity. This is part of this, I would say, different relation when the Americas appear in the world order of the North, the States, Canada, and Latin America. Latin America as a continent balkanized all the different countries, right? But this is the difference. And the Jews may be seen following probably this approach as a signifier. What does it mean? There were three main, I would say, synthetic levels of the problematic of the Jew as other. Individualism or the stranger within the national community. Right? The second, the rootless cosmopolitanism. He has no roots, he has no loyalty, he can't be part of the nation because he belongs to all the nations, and a kind of group solidarity that enters in contradiction with the nation. So Jews. We will see, but not only in Latin America, of course, or not only, represented either the atomization of the nation or the alternative mode of belonging that may be subnational or transnational. I refer to, and I will in a minute refer to that, that Europe knew it when the two main conceptions to build modernity came, Enlightenment and the historical revisionism, historical nationalism. And I would say that when I refer to nationalism and politicized ethnicities, I will give an example. Latin America has different codes of inclusion and exclusion. You see, for example, the South, where we call Euro-America because immigration changed the profile of the population, or Indo-America, which is where local native population continues and immigration didn't change. In both cases, and for different reasons, in Euro-America liberalism and in Indo-America, the idea of miscellaneous, of mestizaje, had difficult facing the Jewish condition. Yes, Michelle, I hope that people can follow us because can we?
Okay. Alors, donc, le raisonnement qu'elle a proposé dans le schéma précédent n'est pas linéaire. Hein, tout ça est en interaction, bien entendu. Alors, ce schéma, ce n'est pas un raisonnement comme ça qu'il faut suivre de manière linéaire. Alors, les choses commencent par la recherche de la modernité pour aboutir à la critique radicale de la modernité. Alors, les Juifs dans tout ça, et donc là, premièrement, enfin, ils sont un signifiant, signifier, ils sont un signifiant qui peut vouloir dire trois choses assez différentes. Ou bien le Juif, c'est... incarne l'individualisme, c'est l'étranger au sein de la communauté nationale. Ou bien, ce qui n'est pas la même chose, le juif, c'est le cosmopolite sans racines. Ou bien, troisième possibilité, le juif, c'est une solidarité de groupe à l'intérieur de la nation et peut-être en conflit avec la nation. Donc, ces trois images différentes du juif, ce n'est pas la même chose, et ça peut même être contradictoire. Ce qui amène à penser que les juifs représentent ou bien, enfin, signifient ou bien l'atomisation de la nation, ou bien d'autres modes d'appartenance que appartenir à la nation, et que ces autres modes d'appartenance peuvent être sous ou sur. Peut être dans l'excès ou dans le défaut, si vous voulez, par rapport à la nation, subnationaux ou supra-transnationaux. Oui. Alors, tout ceci fait que, quel que soit le modèle, ou bien on est dans une situation plutôt de type euro-américaine, c'est-à-dire que c'est les immigrants venus d'Europe qui ont façonné le pays, ou bien on est plutôt dans une situation qu'elle appelle indo-américaine, c'est-à-dire une situation où les populations indiennes antérieures à l'arrivée des colons, de Christophe Colomb, sont restées très très fortes. Il y a ces deux modèles quand même assez différents. Dans les deux cas, compte tenu de tout ce qui vient d'être dit, il y a des grandes difficultés à affronter l'existence même de juifs. L'Amérique latine a des codes différents d'inclusion et d'exclusion.
Yes, et merci Michel, merci beaucoup. Et if I want to exemplify, I will say, and I brought this later, I will try to do it shorter, but I feel that this is the macro understanding of a very complex situation and a very complex continent. But I want to exemplify. For example, for liberalism in the South, the public sphere was a sphere where all the immigrants were invited to be. And for all the groups of immigrants, there was a madre patria, the mother homeland, right? For Jews, they organized, but their organization was connected to other centers of Jewish diaspora. So this was very difficult. And we'll see it even in expression of liberal regimes. In the case of Indo-America, the idea was mestizaje, miscellaneous, to bring together, right? But you may take the case of Mexico, and I believe that Argentina and Mexico are two very enlightening opposite situations. But in the case of Indo-America, the legitimate inhabitants of the New Mexican were Native and Catholic Hispanic. No other strangers were seen as legitimate. And I brought this because I want to move now to a situation where we can see the transnationalization of prejudice and also what means anti-Semitism without Jews. And I refer that while, as I said, in Europe, in modern Europe, there was this discussion in between Enlightenment and Romantic historicism, equal rise versus exclusion because they are not part of the nation. In Latin America, the discussion has been in between liberals and conservatives. And one example of this close, close interaction has been the impact of the affair Dreyfus on the region. Differing from Europe, in the region, there was the context of economic dependency and not the transition to imperialism. But what we see, and I bring again the example of Mexico, that during the dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz, 30 years, that preceded the revolution, the group of the governing elite was called the científicos, the scientists. They were not scientists, but that's the way they were called because of their positivist conception, right? The anti-scientifico discourse took the shape of anti-Semitic ideology, even though in the group of scientificos there were no Jews. The scientifico became the avatar of the Jew, the symbol of finance capital and the symbol of a cosmopolite. And the anti-scientifico rhetoric targeted a figurative Jews rather than a literal Jew. And what we see here is the image of the traitor within. The treason was done within. And I will exemplify it like this. The scientificos was the traitor within. They represented the finance capital and cosmopolitanism. They were seen as they don't belong to any nation, but they are cowardly and calculating group. I'm bringing textual quotes, and I'll say in 1 minute, they are not liberals, they neither conservative, and they have no loyalties, selfishness, materialists, powerful main economic resources. All these, I'm quoting one of the main intellectual leaders of the revolution, the Mexican Revolution, and afterwards of the immigration policy, right? You see here, the Mexican científico, they were part of the elite of the dictatorship, and they wanted to modernize Mexico. And he defines Luis Cabrera as the primordial type of the Jew. In this country, there has never been a worse social plague than the científico community. They were heading a social revolution. That's very important, a progressive social revolution. Mexico, differing from the rest of Latin America, had its revolution. And he continues, the very nature of the scientificos has been metallized, turned to money, just like the conscience of the Jew. If we speak either of raw materials or the development of the trains or commercial transaction, to the Jew, who's a descendant of the Jew, it's just the same. And what I said, right? So no loyalty, selfish materialist. So I come back to the previous slide to let Michelle explain what I referred. I referred that mainly in the struggles between liberals and conservatives, and in the case of Mexico that was heading the social revolution, the image of the Jew without Jews, because Jewish immigration to Mexico as a collective phenomenon only started in the last, very last years, but was of the 19th century, was interrupted by the revolution and started in the 20s. So what we see here is the example that I gave before. Michel, sorry, I think...
Non, c'est compliqué, mais c'est très intéressant. Donc, en gros, je reviens au début de ce qui a été dit dans cette séquence. Si vous êtes du côté donc, des gens plutôt européens, européens-américains, les autres immigrants ont une mère patrie. Ils peuvent se référer à une mère patrie. Les Juifs, eux, ne peuvent se référer qu'à d'autres communautés juives de la diaspora juive. Donc, ce n'est pas les mêmes références. Si vous êtes maintenant du côté indo-américain, c'est-à-dire où y a la question du métissage est posée très, très fortement, au Mexique, ce qui est différent d'ailleurs de l'Argentine, au Mexique, le métissage, c'est uniquement avec des catholiques hispaniques. Les autres étrangers ne comptent pas, n'existent pas. Donc le juif n'a pas sa place, pour le dire autrement, dans la vision qu'on peut avoir à l'époque du métissage. Ensuite, on en arrive à ce thème si intéressant de l'antisémitisme sans juif. Et je dirais, moi, la façon dont un groupe qui n'est pas juif devient juif dans le discours, dans un certain discours politique à l'époque de l'affaire Dreyfus. En Europe, il y a l'affaire Dreyfus. En Amérique latine, ça prend un tout autre tour que Judith illustre avec ce qui se faisait appeler, qu'on appelait les scientificos, les scientifiques. Les scientifiques, c'est des élites qui pilotent le Mexique à l'époque d'avant la Révolution. Hein, c'est Porfirio Diaz, hein, c'est ça. Et donc, ces scientifiques sont des gens, on dirait en Europe, ce sont des gens qui croient dans le progrès, dans l'industrie, dans la science, dans le développement, des Saint-Simoniens, si vous voulez, un peu des Saint-Simoniens, hein, pour avoir une image idéologique de qui sont ces gens-là. Eh bien, ces gens-là, alors qu'ils ne sont pas juifs, aucun parmi eux n'est juif, ces gens-là vont être traités et caractérisés comme juifs. Ce sont des traîtres, ce sont des traîtres de l'intérieur. Donc, vous voyez, le thème de l'affaire Dreyfus devient le même. Il y a quelqu'un qui trahit de l'intérieur. Ce sont des gens qui n'appartiennent à aucune nation, qui sont là pour calculer, gagner de l'argent, sans loyauté. Un des leaders même de la révolution mexicaine parlera comme ça de ces scientifiques. Et donc, c'est très intéressant, le pendant de l'affaire Dreyfus au Mexique, c'est quelque chose donc de très, très différent. C'est l'accusation de tout ce qui fait un groupe être traité de juif alors que les gens ne sont pas juifs. Et c'est donc tous ces stéréotypes, l'argent, la traîtrise, etc., les thèmes qui sont les mêmes que les thèmes européens, mais cette fois-ci sans juifs.
Exactement. Merci, Michel. Merci. This is one really example. Now, to bring the example of how what we refer to the geological levels, to the tropos, the building of the tropos, we go, to different moments where we see the redefinition of this conception. Generally talking, America Latina emerges during the 20s and the 40s as the territory where Jewish migration can arrive, first escaping the deterioration of their social, economical, and political situation, and afterwards, escaping Nazism, right? So what I found, and I must tell you, that in my research, I worked before this, and then I went back to see what happened with the intellectuality that was behind the revolution. So migration became a prominent sphere in which different concepts of the nation and the desired type of society was expressed, and there anti-Semite expressions were articulated. And here, and I think that here Michelle and I will really agree, we can have a transnational look into the past and see the interconnected and the separate histories that took place. First, I would say, the policies of governments, then the right nationalism and the progressive nationalism, then the role of intellectuals and the different contexts. So we don't have time. I'll send to you this material, but what I did was in several works to see how the tropos is produced and reproduced. So in Mexico, but then I'll give the example of Argentina and we'll go faster. Connected histories means that in international forum, the situation of the Jews was discussed. What happened? First, after the idea of promoting Jews to overcome the destruction of the revolution, in the 30s, I jump directly to the 30s, we start to see, but not only the 20s, the 30s, and until 41, when escaping Europe was the only possibility of survival, we see that in the international spheres, for example, if you work the Evian Conference in 38 to discuss where the Jews should go, or later other conferences that were taking place in America, the government was receiving reports from Europe and was seeing the Jews as a problem. They are an exclusive caste. These are the representative of Mexico. I don't want to simplify. I don't want to omit the complexity, because we should remember it was in Mexico the time of President Cárdenas, the oil expropriation, the bilateral conflict with the states. But what I found is that there was an overlapping of the argument of this myth, of these negative tropos. For example, those who wrote from Europe saying, pay attention, this is seen as a surplus population. They are known as Zimbabwe. They are Modilenders. Here we start to see the anti-Semitic organization. But we see also they are the carrier of the Jewish communist conspiracy. Now, not with the científicos that they are the agent of money and capitalism, but the communist Jewish conspiracy. They are destroyers of commerce, the right intellectuals mainly, right? They are a source of secularizing, right? Each of these arguments brings together dozens of documents and media in which this was discussed. Now, the uniqueness of Mexico is that Mexico, differing from the other countries in Latin America, opened its doors to the Spanish exile, but to the Jewish exiles were closed. So here we have really a situation where there was a bifurcation of nationalism. The progressive nationalism from the government that got trapped in the pressure of anti-Semitic association of commercial industrial interests. And as I said, here we have a discursive resource that had practical consequences. Immigration was not meaningful, and rescue, exile, was impossible for Mexico. Over all the period, less than 2,000 Jews could enter. Imagine how it was seen on the light of the deterioration of the situation in Europe. Shall I stop here, Michel?
Yes, please. Yes, please, ça fait beaucoup, beaucoup de choses. Donc, si elle regarde les différentes couches géologiques, en quelque sorte, qui ont façonné le discours de la haine des Juifs, elle va regarder plus spécialement les années 20-40, parce que là, il se passe des choses vraiment importantes dans laquelle la question juive est inséparable de la question de l'immigration. Des phénomènes d'immigration. Et donc, elle évoque les différents éléments qui pèsent sur tout ceci, le rôle des intellectuels, la politique du gouvernement, etc. Et elle considère l'histoire qu'elle appelle connectée, c'est aujourd'hui une façon de faire de l'histoire globale, si vous voulez, qu'on appelle l'histoire connectée. Elle considère l'histoire connectée internationale. Bon, il y a des grandes conférences où on se demande, où les Juifs eux-mêmes se demandent réfléchissent à leur situation dans ces années 30 et au niveau international se demandent surtout où aller lorsqu'ils sont Juifs d'Europe. Au Mexique, qui est un cas un peu singulier par rapport au reste de l'Amérique latine, on a dans ce contexte-là un ensemble d'éléments qui poussent tous dans le même sens, refuser que les Juifs puissent migrer depuis l'Europe pour rejoindre le Mexique. Les thèmes, c'est les Juifs, alors il y a des thèmes antisémites, ils vont amener un surplus de population fait de prêteurs d'argent, de communistes qui conspirent, de gens qui détruisent le pays, qui détruisent le commerce, qui détruisent l'économie, et un certain nombre d'arguments comme ça vont être mis en avant, et du coup, la question de l'accueil même des Juifs dans un pays comme le Mexique devient difficile, y compris chez les gens qui étaient plutôt progressistes. Hein, c'est une sorte de bifurcation du nationalisme qui s'opère, y compris dans ces dimensions plutôt progressistes. On ne sauve pas les Juifs, donc au Mexique, il y a quelques centaines, c'est ça, de Juifs qui vont pouvoir entrer au Mexique pendant cette période où il y en a des très grands nombres qui essayent de fuir l'Europe. Et donc, elle insiste là-dessus, il y a à la fois du discours, mais aussi des choses très pratiques, très concrètes.
Merci, Michel, merci. There is a last comment I want to say. If you can see, here we have the Jewish communist conspiracy. We have here agent of capitalism, right? Of course, all the other qualifications. And where do we find this? This has been the media, the press, all the press has been the territory where public discussion was held. I will continue, I will skip other situation, and I want to come to Argentina as the opposite case, right? Because here, what I find very important is not only what happened in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, but also it has a very, I would say, global impact on the on all the conception. Because what we see in the case of Mexico is that this despite the liberal idea of migration, Jews were seen as the antithesis of the Argentinian. Again, here appears the national identity in Hispanic Catholicism, but also in Italian, French, German. And here it develops simultaneously the idea of global Jewish conspiracy, of Judeo-Bolshevism, of agent of capitalism. I would rather say, I regret I don't have the time, but one of the important things I want, I will skip, but I want to stay in one point. In Argentina, 40s, 50s, and I'm coming in with Tacuara to the 60s, what we see is the impact of the discourse on physical violence. And we see the development of something very, very unique. For the left, they were agent of capitalism, an agent of imperialism. For the right wing, they were destroyers, moral threat. But what appears there before any other region is the what we know historically, the double loyalty. And because in the 50s and 60s and 60s will happen the Eichmann affair, which was the capture of the Nazi criminal and brought to Israel to be judged there, they offered, I mean, they developed, not offered, developed, the main reason was that they were carrier of a double loyalty, they were servers of Israel, and it started there in the 50s, this strong anti-Semite discourse of anti-Zionism, which nothing has to do with what we may see afterward, which may be the critique of Israel or the not acceptance of the Zionist diagnosis. But here what we see is that anti-Zionism offered the articulation of the hate. It was totally, I'm talking about the 60s, and I am talking about the Eichmann in Jerusalem, right? The name of Hannah Arendt's book, right? So if I go and I continue because I'm thinking, the Eichmann affair accelerated the argument of double loyalty. And I would say this, it legitimized the anti-Semite xenophobic ideology that was developing in Argentina, as we all know. And this time it required a new element, was the anti-Zionist as a doctrinal need to explain the conspiracy theory. Argentina has been the territory of conspiracy theory. So it offered as a method of interpreting history by a mythical many-headed synarchy, La Sinarquía Internacional. The Jews were seen and developed as the international synarchy, right? So here, what I refer synthetically, Michelle, and you will translate, is precisely how we do see, I don't enter in a very problematic discussion that Europe knows it and social sciences knows it. Was populism, was peripheral fascism a way to incorporate the excluded groups from the limited republic that was that was then run by the oligarchy? Was it the case? Or finally, this idea of a strong state to bring and carry development, what did was impacted the limits and backwards of democracy. I think this is an ongoing discussion. I can't stay here. I'm working on that. I've worked and I'm working again because there are new voices discussing it when populism today is discussed, right? So what I wanted here to bring then, that omitting the concept of peripheral fascism, in the case of Argentina, we also see overlapping of argument, a much more extreme anti-Semitism than in the case of Mexico, no doubt, and the argument of the double loyalty and anti-Zionism appearing in the scene. And we are talking about the Eichmann affair and the redefinition, I call it the redefinition of boundaries of collectivities. Jews are foreigner, are subversive. There is the plot and this all the theory of synarchism that has survived and pervived also when Argentina arrived not only to the military regimes, but also to democratization.
Maybe we could stop here and maybe we could now enter in. On pourrait maintenant ensuite discuter. Je résume ce que vient de dire Judith. En Argentine, c'est très différent du Mexique. C'est presque le contraire. Il y a un, en Argentine, je vais aller assez vite, mais l'Argentine, c'est un pays où, à gauche et à droite, il y a différents discours de haine des Juifs dans les années 20, 30, 40. À gauche, on dit les Juifs, c'est le capitalisme et c'est l'impérialisme. À droite, on dit les Juifs détruisent le pays, détruisent la nation, etc. Mais ce qui va se passer de plus intéressant et de plus différent peut-être par rapport au Mexique, c'est ensuite, c'est dans les années 50 et surtout 60 et 70, qu'on va se développer en Argentine, donc ce n'est pas au Mexique, mais c'est en Argentine au départ en tout cas, la thèse de la double loyauté des Juifs. Les Juifs ne sont pas loyaux uniquement pour l'Argentine, parce qu'ils sont loyaux aussi pour Israël. Et ce thème va prendre une force considérable au moment de l'affaire Eichmann. Alors, je rappelle pour ceux qui, si c'est nécessaire, Eichmann, c'est donc ce criminel nazi qui se cache à peine d'ailleurs en Argentine, à peine. Si on veut le trouver, on le trouve. Et en Argentine, un beau jour, les services secrets israéliens le kidnappent, le mettent dans un avion, l'amènent en Israël pour qu'il soit jugé, et ce sera un événement d'une importance mondiale énorme, avec le célèbre livre de Hannah Arendt qui s'appelle « Eichmann à Jérusalem », qui est un livre classique, évidemment. Et cette affaire va renforcer la thèse de « les Juifs, c'est la double allégeance ». Les Juifs, c'est l'allégeance à l'Argentine, mais aussi et d'abord à Israël. Et donc, l'antisémitisme en Argentine va prendre cette forme d'un complotisme, d'une théorie de la conspiration extrêmement active, liée donc à ce thème, à l'existence de l'État d'Israël. Non pas pour critiquer, comme aujourd'hui c'est souvent le cas, la politique israélienne, la question palestinienne, etc. Non, pas du tout. C'est Israël vu comme la première référence des Juifs argentins qui ne sont donc pas pleinement adhérents, si je peux dire, à la nation. Et cette question-là, on va la retrouver à travers le populisme des années 40, 50, 60, et puis après la dictature militaire, y compris donc dans la période plus proche démocratique. Donc, tout ceci, on n'a pas le temps de rentrer dans.
Michel, merci tu l'as présenté synthétique.
Voilà. Alors, je vous propose, parce qu'on pourrait prendre maintenant une demi-heure pour discuter avec Judith, parce que l'heure a passé, mais on a bien vu la différence entre les deux expériences. Donc, je vous propose d'ouvrir la discussion, parce que tout ceci nous fait rentrer dans un univers auquel, depuis la France, nous ne sommes pas très habitués. Et donc, je pense qu'il y a de nombreuses questions. Donc, voilà, la discussion. La discussion est ouverte. Qui souhaite intervenir?
Je veux animer la discussion comme tu le proposais, Michel, mais peut-être poser d'abord deux questions à Judith. I will like to ask you, Judith, first, were the Jews seen as a race in Latin America in the 1920s, 30s, 40s? Was the was there an anthropological and biological definition of Jews seen as a race? This is my first question. And the other question, also in the 30s, there was this interesting intellectual movement that the writer Mario Vargas Llosa called the archaic utopia. It was a socialist movement connected with indigenous people, and was in this movement that happened in Peru and other countries around, was there a kind of anti-Semitism or not at all? Est-ce que je dois traduire en français peut-être parce que...
Résume tes deux questions très vite.
Oui, non, oui, alors bah, très vite, la première chose, c'est est-ce que en Amérique latine, dans les années 20 et 30, l'idée anthropologique de la race était présente, c'est-à-dire l'idée d'une définition biologique de la race, vraiment au sens des anthropologues racialistes de la fin du 19e siècle et des années 20-30. Ça, c'est ma première question. On sait que c'était très important en Europe et en Amérique du Nord, et qu'en était-il de l'Amérique latine? J'en ai aucune idée, d'où ma question. Et la deuxième question, c'est, ça concerne le mouvement que l'écrivain Mario Vargas Llosa a appelé l'utopie archaïque, c'est-à-dire c'est le renouveau indigéniste au sein des intellectuels socialistes, disons, qui ont connecté leurs questions avec des questions culturelles liées aux indigènes, aux peuples indigènes, aux peuples autochtones, on dirait maintenant. Et donc, je me demandais si ce mouvement-là, qui me semble très intéressant, est-ce qu'il est imprégné ou non, ou pas du tout, d'antisémitisme.
Judith.
Oui. It's okay. I'll answer to you in English, right, Roger? Two questions are very important because, as I said at the beginning, we should be aware that historically there has been the problem of racialization of cultures and of religions, right? Mm-hmm. But what we see during the 30s and the 40s is the impact, the transnational, what I call the interconnected histories and separate histories of the Jewish question. And what we see here is two different expressions. The first one, the transnationalization and the transnational transmission of the different stereotypes. So in there, the concept of race was already developed in Europe by fascism, by Nazism, and it had an impact. Now, what is interesting is that if you look at in Latin America, not only, I mean, not in all, but I will take, of course, Peru, of course, Mexico, all the projects of integrating the nation, where you find the overlapping of categories. You have a social group that is also race, that is also economically and socially in certain scale, and also is seen as a political actor. In other terms, the miscellaneous of indigenous and European Hispanic Catholics, for example, was seen precisely, not was seen, was a consequence of the same initial defining fact of the conquest. I mean, ethnicity or race, and on this we have a discussion, right? When race becomes ethnicity and when ethnicity became race. So the indigenous people were seen as a category, right? Of course, there was race. but also as a socio-economic category, but also as a political category. The mestizo was seen, for example, in the case of Mexico, as the new Mexican. Now, what happened here? The Jews were excluded from this idea of the convergence or miscellaneous or mestizaje. And the most clear example is a figure that historically has a very strong influence in the continent, which is José Vasconcelos. Vasconcelos is the author of a very important work, an idea of the world race, a race that would include all the races, right?
La race cosmique.
Exactly, the race cosmique, exactly. So in this race cosmique for Vasconcelos, there was no place for the Jews, neither for the native people. The native should have been already engaged with the Hispanic Catholic population. Now, going to Vargas Llosa, you can continue. You can look at the, which has a very important impact in Europe and in France, as you well know, the Movimiento Zapatista, right? Mm-hmm. Over there, if you read at the first declarations of both in Peru and here, the problem of race comes in a very surprising way, or not surprising, the whitening of the Jew. The Jew becomes a white member of the dominant group. What means? They couldn't enter the country because they were Jews. But in the moment that this native essentially discourse develops, it whitens the Jews. They become white. And we will not have time today, but I have, you know, Michelle, I will send you. I have exactly probably left outside half of the conference, half of the lecture, that has to be also with the contemporary post-colonial and decolonial critique that brings the problem of Jews' sin as part of the white Western dominant culture and Juan's dominant matrix of power and knowledge. So you see, what we have here is different moments of the racialization, right, of the Jews. In Argentina, the situation was different. Even though during a period, for example, of democratization, before what I called evanescent or dissolvent democracies or de-democratization, for the government, these groups that were anti-Semitic were a sort of backbone, a sort of fence against what was seen as the left Bolshevik Soviet influence. Here you see exactly the two dimensions. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you.
D'autres questions? Oui, oui. Régis, je te laisse gérer.
Oui, Betty Mendlovic.
Oui, j'ai une question. In this historical long context, I'm curious about the role that the Freemasons, many of them Jewish Freemasons, play in this ideological and political game. If you can say so.
Well, you know, Betty, that it's interesting. I must say that among all the disgrace, negative impact of our COVID era, this possibility of get together bring us, she is my student in Mexico, eminent doctor, a great research, and we have to discuss here what we weren't able to discuss there. That's very interesting. Now, Freemasons was a space, Betty, for these neutral spaces where Jews can find their acceptance. And this was a very important role because all the fraternities and all the secret organizations, and they were essential during, in the case of Mexico, it's very important, all the organization, the Freemasons organization accepted Jews. Jews were part of there. And there is even the idea that Madero also was. They supported, they offered support. So this was a neutral space, if I can say. That's what I would like to say. You know, Michelle, probably because we are already the past of the time, I just will approach the end just announcing what was left out.
Yes, please.
Announcing. Mm-hmm. And of course, as a good guest in your party, I'm open to be with you on a second meeting. I thought from this situation in Argentina, let me come here, right, to really come to where this expanded in the continent when there was the redefinition of discursive strategies, Jews, Zionism, and Israel, and it comes to Mexico and the situation it developed. And the reversion of certain binaries, dialectic binaries. And first, of course, I wanted with something that you have worked so well, Michelle, which is all the anti-globalization movements and how this comes, but here I only present it. And this is my thesis. My main thesis is that anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, and anti-Israelism are different phenomena. But at the meaning-making level, they overlap. And this is the force of our analysis of the discursive, right? Especially when it can bring, because of different motivations, and different purposes, it came really what is, I think, the threshold of acceptance, of rejection, is stronger. Then I wanted to bring before you, Michelle, I didn't know to which one refer because you have several. I wanted to ask yesterday and I didn't. What are part of the debate? Of the debate if anti-Zionism is or not a new form of anti-Semitism. And of course the other, which mainly see it as a unjustified critique, and this comes to the role of Israel. From there, I wanted to come, I have to work this, what does it mean, the transnationalism of prejudice? And of course, to the post and decolonization, this matrix of colonialism, knowledge, power, and what I said to you, Regi, the de-racialization of the Jews. Mm-hmm. From this, we come to chains of transmission. What happens when the internet, because of anonymity, immediacy, and global nature, brings, and I have the data for Latin America, and what happens really of the radicalization of a tropos, of a negative tropos. I took again Argentina and Mexico. This has been new for me, working with the internet. I approach the end with asking the different levels, what is in the concept of sinopia and pentimenti. It is the universal and the particular, Jews, the conceptual and the practical, the symbolic and the material, the ephemeral and the structural, the multiple matrices and the old and new. And well, let me tell you that I have really several proposals of what can be some concluding remarks, but this is not now the place, but I will be satisfied if I will send to you, as I committed, this translated. I really think that Michel did a great work in translating me. No, really, you captured the essence.
One short question. You were saying that this the re-racialization of the Jews that were becoming white happened in Latin America, and also in the recently with the decolonial movement, if I understood you well.
Yes.
Do you think this could be an explanation that in this movement there's an interest into racism and not into anti-Semitism? Because in this movement, Jews are seen as white and not so the struggle and the politics is the interest goes into racism and not anti-Semitism. I'm not clear, maybe.
You were clear, Reggie. Let me just answer to you. You know that one of the great contributions of the colonial and post-colonial approach is the concept of the global South.
Mm-hmm.
The global South as a space of liberation from the West, right?
Yes.
And it has to do with what I started saying, that the expansion of the West was a forced periphery in the world system, right? Wallerstein and the polypheries and the polycenters, right? So the aim of authors are of recovering the unseen history, the latent, the not seen history. So the matrix of colonialism is knowledge and power, right? So what happened here and what comes with the racialization of the Jew? Jews are seen, and this is related, of course, with the state of Israel, no doubt, in the case of Mignolo and Gottsfogel, that are central figures, right? What happens? Israel is seen as an expansion of the colonial power and not as the option of a subjugated minority post-Holocaust, right? That had all this idea that started in the 19th century, how to solve the Jewish question, right? So over there were the big dialogues and debates, in Europe, not in Europe, international, the left, cultural option, etc. Meanwhile, Holocaust arrives and the population that was discussing the solution ceased to exist, right? The Holocaust. So what happens is that for Mignolo and Grossfogel as other, the Jew is seen as part of the West, of the capitalist West. And there is only one Jew, the rich Jew, or the imperial Jews, or the Constantine Jew, right? And Israel is seen as in complicity with the West, not as a territory for rescue of the remnants of the Holocaust, you see? And from this comes the Holocaust as a Western Eurocentric paradigm that erases other colonial genocide. You know, here we share France, Mexico, Argentina, the States. And I will see that, of course, the Middle East conflict, mainly for, look, both Mignolo and Grossfogel are Latin Americans and central figures, right? Mm-hmm. So the Middle East conflict is focused on Israel and is considered to originate the Zionist enterprise. So this is the problem. So it's not that, let's put it this way, Reggie, it's not that it's part of an anti-racist struggle, that I recognize the concept of Global South is very important, and this idea of the matrix of power. But in the case of Jews, I think that here, because of the position of identification with the Palestinian people, seeing the solution not as the possibility of two states for two people, and we all today are really worried because of the election and what's going on, really worried. But what we see here is that Jews suddenly become white. Let me just finish with one paradoxical point, Reggie. Today, I mean this last time, in the United States, the big, big discussion is the existence of Jews of colors, which means, for example, Latin American Jews, Oriental Jews, Black that enter community, or Middle Eastern Jews, Hispanic Jews, Sephardi, all of them are seen as Jews of color in the categories of the American scene. You see, that's really a paradox, because it also, finally, that's my thesis, I know that it's very critical, this also widens the Jews, because it means that the Jewish community in the States has its own Jews of colors. The American society has its color minority. So we continue on this. Sorry, Michelle, if I extended myself.
No, I think that we could consider that this could be the last word for tonight. It was very interesting. It's always so important, I believe, to have other perspectives than French or European, very centrical visions of what is at stake. So thanks a lot to Judith. And yes, we shall invite you for another meeting, Judith. We shall see when and how, but for sure, we must keep on discussing with you. It was very useful.